And now, back to Brainstorming with Billy.
The Living Brain.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara Counties. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is connecting with people. Each of my guests is explaining how his or her subject connects with people. My next guest is an expert on marriage in the post-romantic age. We'll examine workhorse wives, royal children, undersex spouses, and rebel couples who are rewriting the rules of marriage from her book, Marriage Confidential. And if you want to ask a question or if you want to join in the conversation, you can call us at 639-0008. Pamela Haig earned her Ph.D. in history from Yale University after attending Swarthmore College. She has worked as the director of research for an American Association of University Women and as a speechwriter. And she has written for the American Scholar, the Christian Science Monitor, the Michigan Quarterly Review, the Huffington Post, and NPR, among others. She's had fellowships from the National Endowment of the Humanities and from the Mellon Foundation and has a postdoctorate fellowship at Brown University. Obviously a very well-educated woman. Joining us from Maryland. Hi, Pamela. How are you today?
Hi, I'm great.
Well, thank you so much for being our guest. And you've done a lot of extensive work on the subject of marriage and really sort of opened my eyes to the new sorts of trends that are happening in marriage right now. Your book is filled with statistics about the way marriage is today. And some of those statistics reveal to me a very confusing picture. For instance, in the book you say 96% of single people want a soulmate in marriage, first and foremost. That's their number one criteria if you're single. Yet, 40% of Americans think that marriage is becoming obsolete, and one in three Scottish women deem that marriage is no longer necessary or even relevant. So help me to reconcile this schizophrenia that we seem to be having.
Well, I'm drawing on a few different surveys there. The picture is genuinely really complicated today. And I think Americans are torn. I don't think they are decided as to whether marriage is sort of the pillar of society or irrelevant. And the statistics reflect that and embody that. The statistic for marriage becoming obsolete, that comes from Pew Research from November 2010, and it's even higher among younger Americans who, in that case, half, 50% believe marriage is becoming obsolete.
Wow.
Yes. But at the same time, when they're asked what they would ideally want from marriage, they do have a very lofty goal, you know, of having someone who is going to fulfill all of these soulmate roles and dreams. But the soulmate concept is interesting because in some ways it's not really a romantic concept. A soulmate is a term that's applied to good friends, to colleagues, to neighbors. So in some ways, it's a very perhaps unrealistic goal, but not necessarily entirely a romantic goal for marriage.
Well, and that gets into a concept that you call the intimacy blur that seems to be happening today. So since people are looking for soulmates, but soulmate can be applied to so many different people. It can be applied to your boss at work. It can be applied to your dog, I suppose.
That's right.
You're probably not going to have intimate relationships with your dog. At least I hope not.
Let's hope not.
So, you know, spouses are acting more and more like friends. There are a term out there, friends with benefits, starting to act more and more like spouses. Colleagues becoming workplace spouses. I thought that was interesting. Spouses treating each other like colleagues or business partners. So talk to me about this blur that we're seeing in intimacy as we have this soulmate concept.
Yeah, well, the intimacy blur, as you've really described well, is my term for the ways in which a whole bunch of relationships are coming to resemble each other, for they used to be really distinct. So a lot of people who are married, who actually are already married and have kind of given up on that soulmate dream, in my survey, 50% said, you know, marriage is really more like a friendship these days than anything else. Then meanwhile, you have some friendships that are so intense, particularly for single people, and you have friends with benefit where the friendship kind of has a sexual component as well. And in the past few years, we've even seen the emergence of terms such as workplace spouse, where people feel very close to the colleagues that they spend, you know, 8 or 10 hours a day with. And sometimes they feel closer to their work partners than they do to their partner partners. And the thing that really summarizes this intimacy blur, if you look at marriage vows, at wedding vows, you know, as I did, I reviewed a whole bunch of the most popular wedding vows. And increasingly, husbands and wives say, well, I'm going to be your life partner and I want to be your best friend. That has almost become the gold standard in wedding vows. So there's less of a sense that marriage is totally different from other relationships in our lives. It seems to be kind of blurring into them.
Well, we're trying to get some clarity around the whole idea of marriage from my guest, Pamela Haig, author of the book Marriage Confidential, The Post-Romantic Age of Workhorse Wives, Royal Children, Undersex Spouses, and Rebel Couples Who Are Rewriting the Rules. And this concept of life partners that you just described, Pamela, in the wedding vows and so forth, that's an interesting one, too, because there's a body of research that finds historically an unprecedented, what you call assertive mating, where more people are marrying people that are very much like themselves. The camaraderie is more important than being complementary. Talk to me about this life partners, and particularly help me to understand assertive mating.
Yeah, assortative mating.
Assortative mating, sorry.
This is one of the major trends over the last 5 or 6 decades in marriage. Increasingly, researchers have found husbands and wives are more like each other in education and career and earning potential and life experiences. They're much more like each other than they've ever been before. In the 1940s and 1950s, it was somewhat more likely, for example, that a high school educated woman might marry a college educated man, and you'd see a kind of jumping across class. That's less likely to happen today. It's much more the case that husbands and wives are kind of marrying each other. They're marrying people that have very similar biographies to their own. And so the good news there is that they do have a lot of compatibility. They've had really similar experiences. They have almost a collegial kind of familiarity with each other. The danger and the bad news is that once you get married, the relationship can come to be too much like a colleague relationship, or it can come to feel too much like it's only friends or partners. So the marriage can lose some of that traction.
Now, what does it mean for the children of a marriage where people are married with assortative mating?
Well, interestingly, some of the research on this paints a troubling picture, because they say that as equality kind of grows between husbands and wives, which is a good thing, much more inequality grows between families, so that if you have couples who are hyper well-educated and they have one or two children and they pour all their resources into educating their children, that family is going to accumulate more wealth, they're going to be better off, and then if you have families that don't have those advantages, it's likely to kind of exacerbate some of the inequalities between families and between marriages.
Wow. My guest is Pamela Haig, author of the book Marriage Confidential. In the book, Pamela, you describe the semi-happy marriage, which is a low-conflict, melancholy sort of an arrangement, and you've got some statistics to support that. 30% of the couples that you surveyed think that most marriages that they see are neither happy nor unhappy, mm-hmm. but somewhere in between. And then another 40% think that most aren't really that happy at all.
Right.
I mean, that's kind of the theme of your book. So what is the semi-happy marriage, and why are we seeing so many people staying in these semi-happy marriages?
Yeah, well, they're good questions. The semi-happy marriage is kind of the dirty little secret of marriage today. Like, when we look at our neighbors' marriages, we often don't have very positive assessments of them. A semi-happy marriage is not bad enough to leave, but it's not good enough to be fulfilling for the partners who are in it. So it lives in this gray zone between just being terrible and you're ready to get divorced and being truly satisfying. A semi-happy marriage is different than a contented marriage. A contented marriage goes along in a very stable keel, but it feels good about itself. The semi-happy marriage is one that's often very boring, lackluster, listless, lacking and incomplete, you know, for one of the spouses. But at the same time, it has some qualities that do work. You know, sometimes the couple can get along pretty well, or they function well as friends, but one or two key elements are missing. And I think that, you know, we've always had this kind of marriage with us, certainly. But I think it's the reasons why people stick with it today. One of the interesting reasons, of course, is the recession. You know, for the last 3 years, people just can't afford to get divorced, and they can't sell their houses. So a lot of couples that before might have marched themselves to divorce court are kind of forced to stay put because they just can't afford to split up. Some of the other reasons, I think, have to do with a commitment to sticking acting it out. I think that men and women my age, you know, in their 30s and 40s, a lot of them really internalize that idea of, you know, divorce is a huge failure and I'm not going to do it. You know, some of them grew up in families with divorce and didn't want to do that to their own children. And some of them are just trying to be really focused on the kids, you know, and they're just saying, well, I can't do that to my children. So there are a variety of reasons.
There are. But it leads to something that you call the Oreo marriage. What is the Oreo marriage?
Oh, yeah. The Oreo marriage is totally traditional on the outside, and it's secretly untraditional on the inside. So this is a couple that, you know, looks to be just the neighbor next door, the marriage next door, and they're doing all the usual things and going to their PTA meetings and paying bills and what have you. And maybe on the weekends, you know, they're going to swinging parties or they're in open marriages, you know, or they're doing things a little differently on the inside and in private. And this is what I mean by rebel couples.
And are they becoming an increasing percentage of the marriages that you surveyed?
Well, I'm not sure. It's hard to pinpoint because a lot of that improvisation just goes on in secret. I do think that marriage is in a brainstorming phase right now. So I think that couples are really trying to figure out, how can I have a marriage that adapts to the changing times? You know, the circumstances for marriage are so different than they were 50 or 60 years ago, economically and socially and culturally, just across the board. So I think that marriage generally is in a phase where it needs to evolve. And that really gets at all the confusion you see in the statistics, you know, where people on the one hand don't think marriage has any point, but on the other hand, they still want to give it a try. So my intuition and my sense about this is that there will be more changes in how we define marriage in the future. And I think couples are defining it much more on their own terms. You know, they're trying to figure out, what do I want my marriage to be, instead of just kind of following a script.
My guest is Pamela Haag, author of the book Marriage Confidential. Pamela, we can't talk about marriage without talking about sex. Exactly. And you cite something in your book that you call the avatar lever. And that is where you're a participant in a mental affair that is not physical, it's not corporal, but it occurs entirely online. Talk to me about some of the statistics surrounding this, because 87% of the spouses report that they don't feel guilty about online erotic chat, flirtation, affairs, or even cruising online.
Yeah, you know, technology and the social media are changing marriage at every step along the way, and I was fascinated by that theme. And the avatar lover is one example of this. This is an affair, and there are cases in politics, of course. Anthony Weiner comes immediately to mind. These are affairs that occur entirely online, you know, if we even would call them affairs, where there's an exchange of emails or flirtatious photos or chat and texting and sexting. But the couple might never meet. They might never even touch. And there is really, what's so interesting, and there's no consensus yet, if there ever will be, about what this means or what this means in a marriage. You know, is this better than regular old infidelity? Is it worse? Because in some cases it can be more intimate. You know, it could be like a Jane Austen affair of letters. You know, or is it something that spouses can tolerate? I talked to one or two couples who said, you know, we don't really care about online flirting. To them, it was no different than maybe occasionally looking at pornography, which they didn't think was that bad. But for other spouses who have been the victims of this, they thought that it was absolutely just as bad. On the other hand, there's research that the people who do it don't really feel that guilty.
Right.
They feel kind of protected by the anonymity and the fact that they're not actually literally touching someone.
Which is interesting. And I found another interesting statistic in your book. 20% of the entire internet society, the population that's out there, engages in some form of online sexual activity.
Right.
That's a high percentage, isn't it?
It is.
And
I've heard, and I'm sure we've all heard, that that is one of the major functions of the internet. You know, it seems to facilitate these new forms of hooking up. And what's really interesting about online liaison too is that it's easy to be deceiving. You know, it's very easy to hide, and it's also easy to be self-deceiving. You know, it's very easy with Facebook, for example, just to start up a correspondence with an old girlfriend or boyfriend, and it's innocent enough. And then it can kind of slide gradually into something that's more troubling to a marriage. And in Britain, in fact, last year, 1 in 5 of divorce petitions mentioned Facebook, which I found very intriguing.
That is an incredible statistic. My guest is Pamela Haig. Pamela, you mentioned it in an earlier answer that marriage is in a brainstorming stage. I like that. So I want to ask the question to you. Are we entering an era of marriage 3.0? Like software has revisions, marriage has revisions. Marriage 1.0 was the 19th century version of marriage, which was social duty, obligation, and sacrament. Marriage 2.0 was the 20th century, the romantic ideal. It's an emotional bond and love attachment that you have. So what's marriage 3.0 going to be?
Yeah, well, that is the big question. And that's the term I use in the book for what's going to happen in the post-millennial marriage. Some of the ways that I see it happening in the future is I think marriage is going to survive. So I'm not actually, I have a quirky optimism. I'm not actually one of those people who thinks marriage is becoming obsolete. But I don't think it's going to survive by trying to revive the old 19th century form, and nor do I think it's going to survive in its romantic form. I think we're likely to see couples who try to customize and personalize marriage to what they want to get out of it. I think we could see marriage become more explicitly a parenting arrangement, where people decide to get married when they feel like having children, and they look at it mostly as a parenting relationship. I think it's possible that we're going to see marriages that build in more separation, you know, of time and of space. Already we have a lot of distance marriages and commuter marriages.
And to that point, a statistic in your book that I found interesting from the Home Builders of America, that they're building more and more custom homes with 2 master bedroom suites where the husband and wife sleep apart.
Yeah, I thought this was one of those interesting, odd statistics out there that sort of indirectly shines light on marriage. It's a reasonable accommodation. You know, marriages that build in a little sense of different lives and some spaces might be able to withstand better in the long run. You know, and we're living longer and healthier much later, you know, in life, into our lives. And if we want a lifelong commitment, you know, it's not a bad idea to consider marriage sabbaticals or separate rooms or ways to build in some growth time as well.
Very interesting. My guest is Pamela Haig, author of the book Marriage Confidential. And Pamela, I've got to ask you this. In the subtitle of your book, you talk about workhorse wives. What is a workhorse wife for all of my ladies listening in the audience?
Yeah, you might have some listening now. For the workhorse wife, the dream of having it all became the nightmare of doing it all. So these are wives who are usually the sole or the primary breadwinner in the marriage. So they're kind of like the 1950s husband, except that they often end up doing a lot of the household chores and the child rearing as well. And their husbands, meanwhile, are pursuing a big dream. So they're the dream chaser in the marriage, right? They're trying to be a novelist, or they're trying to be a poet, or they're doing something that doesn't really bring in money, but that satisfies them intellectually and professionally. So in a weird way, in the workhorse wife marriage, it's the husband who's pursuing the dream of having it all, and the wife has become kind of the downtrodden breadwinner. And in some ways, it's a quirk on feminism because the husbands are a little more liberated than the wives. And, you know, really the dream of feminism wasn't just to reverse the roles so that wives ended up as the sole breadwinners. It was that husbands and wives should both have marriages that work better.
A little role reversal is the unintended consequence of being a workhorse wife. My guest is Pamela Haig. Pamela is the author of the book Marriage Confidential. Pamela, what do you want readers to take away from reading Marriage Confidential?
I'm really hoping that I'm stretching the reader's imagination about what's possible in marriage. I'm hoping that they come away with more sympathy, you know, for people who are struggling in marriage instead of just chalking it up to them being, you know, overly idealistic or selfish. And I would hope that they would have reduced judgment, you know, toward people who are either divorcing or staying single or struggling to stay married. It's very challenging to stay married sometimes in a time when you do have other options. And that's what a lot of marriages are facing today. And I would hope that they would just come away with a broader sense of what's possible in marriage.
Oh, that's great. Pamela, if people like the sound of your voice, they like what they hear, where would you direct them to go on the Internet to learn more?
Well, they can go to marriageconfidential.com, which has all sorts of reviews and articles about the book. And they can also go to my website, which is PamelaHaig.com.
And spell that, Pamela?
PamelaHaag.com.
PamelaHaag.com or MarriageConfidential.com. Pamela, it has been a true delight. Thank you so much for being my special guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And